There have been skirmishes today in southern Lebanon, but neither Hezbollah nor Israel has escalated the fighting, and Israel has begun slowly withdrawing its troops. Meantime, the presidents of Iran and Syria say the balance of power has changed in the Middle East. Robin Wright is diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
You have already written that things are going to be very different in the Middle East as a result of what happened in Lebanon. How so?
Oh, I think on a lot of different fronts. The Israelis, for the first time, do not appear invincible. They retreated in 2000 as a result of Hezbollah, but this time they did not achieve any of their strategic goals, which were to eliminate, cripple, weaken Hezbollah as a force in southern Lebanon and potentially eliminate some of its top leaders. So it'll go back to the drawing board in terms of trying to figure out how to defend the country against a very different kind of threat. The region also is changed because Hezbollah comes out of this in some ways, not always, but in some ways as a more powerful political force. It has a wider attraction in the Arab world, even if it is going to pay a price domestically, because it is seen as having produced this tragedy. In terms of the balance of power, as you mentioned, Iran feels that it is a stronger player today because its surrogate is Hezbollah. It provided the arms for Hezbollah. And going into the talks next week on its nuclear program, this is not a good time or convenient time for the West, the United States and its European allies. So the United States also has suffered somewhat as a result of that. Even though it came up with a rather masterful compromise and a resolution, the fact that it is widely seen in the region and even in many parts of Europe as a party that not only allowed Israel to continue its bombardment of Lebanon, which the majority of casualties were civilian, but also to have provided the weapons. And I traveled with Condi Rice, and shortly after our trip, there was a big banner put up in Beirut that showed her with fangs coming out of her mouth and blood dripping. And they blame the United States for some of these civilian casualties in particular incidents, such as the one at Qana.
You didn't mention Syria.
Well, I think Syria actually has not gained very much out of this. The fact is that the United States and France, in crafting a resolution, tried to isolate Bashar al-Assad, the president. And although it is an ally of Hezbollah and will gain, perhaps, indirectly, it is, you know, the outside world has tried to isolate it. The French sent an envoy to Iran to discuss a resolution and the outcome of this conflict, but everyone ignored Damascus.
You mentioned the Iranian issue coming up again next week. President Ahmadinejad has said that on August 22nd, he will reply to the offer of economic and technological incentives to suspend uranium enrichment. How do you think these elements that you've just discussed are going to affect Iran's decision?
Well, it's a very good question, Warren, and in fact, a lot will hinge on that. He may calculate that Iran is in a stronger position. In fact, some will argue that Iran is in a stronger position with the outside world than at any point since the 1979 revolution, because it feels its position has been enhanced, that through its help, an Arab group actually engaged in the longest war with Israel, and that Israel, because it didn't achieve its objectives, will appear weaker. Whether it is or not, you know, history will have to decide. But this is a new president who's not deeply experienced in diplomacy, and he may make some rather heady calculations about where Iran stands.
Back to Israel, you say that with a different kind of threat, it's going to have to go back to the drawing board. What do you mean by a different kind of threat?
Well, in this one we saw not the kind of guerrilla challenges that Israel faced during the days of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah is much better armed than it was during Israel's 22-year occupation of southern Lebanon, ending in 2000. Today it has missiles that have penetrated deep inside Israel, not just little Katyusha rockets. And so it's even if it's pushed back behind the Litani, it could still be a significant threat. The trick is going to be obviously the big unknown, the big challenge everyone faces now, and that is whether Hezbollah will agree to be disarmed. And I think that is something that's going to be a very long saga and not will not end as quickly as anyone hopes.
Very quickly, then, you don't think that the international force will have the force necessary to disarm Hezbollah if it doesn't want to be disarmed?
It's not an issue. The mandate does not include disarming Hezbollah. That was one of the things the French insisted on. They are allowed only to use whatever muscle they have available to them to retain peace. It's only if Hezbollah should attack them that they could respond, for example.
As always, Robin Wright with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren.
As you'll hear in a moment, Seymour Hersh is convinced that President Bush wants to attack Iran before he leaves office. In this week's story, he quotes a former senior intelligence official talking about how Vice President Cheney's office viewed the Israeli attack on Lebanon. The quote is, "We can learn what to do in Iran by watching what the Israelis do in Lebanon." I asked Hersh if he meant to say that the U.S. saw the recent battle as a kind of preview of an attack on Iran.
The real picture for this administration, and I think you can just sense it if you want to listen to what the president says publicly about Iran. He went after them again yesterday. Basically, it was they got, from the White House's point of view, Israel going into Hezbollah with air, a major air attack, strategic bombing. And don't forget, the new head of the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, is for the first time an Air Force general named Halutz, who's a great believer in strategic bombing. It's a three or four for us. One, of course, this, as I've been writing in The New Yorker for about a year, this White House has been pushing the Pentagon for a plan to do in Iran, and they've been talking and pushing the Air Force for a major bombing campaign because anything else doesn't make sense. We don't have enough troops, and so the Air Force has been trying, and there's been an internecine war in the Pentagon over the Air Force plans. They're suggesting we can take care of Iran just with a lot of bombs. 80 million people in that country, a lot of defenses. And the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps are saying, are you out of your mind? You know, start bombing, we'll end up with people, you know, boots on the ground. We don't have them. And so there's been this war. Comes this spring, and the Israeli Air Force gets interested in strategic bombing in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. Our Air Force is all over. Cheney hears about it, and it's a great idea. Why? If the bombing, everybody was sure the bombing would work, both in Israel and in the Cheney White House, or I should say the Bush White House, Bush / Cheney. Or maybe it's Cheney Bush, we never know. In any case, the bombing was going to, Israel is a great bombing. They were going to knock out this dug in Nasrallah and Hezbollah. We know that they're dug in, just like the Iranians are dug in much deeper. But Hezbollah, everybody understood, was a tough target. The Israeli Air Force would come, blast them out. The victory would be clear to all, and even those in the Pentagon who are poo-pooing the Air Force, in the American Pentagon who are poo-pooing the Air Force's plans. So it's a plus that way. Strategic bombing can work, shock and awe, which didn't work in Iran, can work here. Two, you get rid of a terrorist. Nasrallah, the Israelis don't like him. Bush doesn't like him. He's the A-team, as I quote somebody, Richard Armitage, is saying. Three, you support the government of Lebanon, the central government, which is much friendly to the United States since Syria left the country under pressure. And it's a more friendly government. Of course, the problem Lebanon has is it's Sunni largely. They have no real control over Hezbollah. He's an independent fiefdom, although he participates in the government and contributes and does social stuff in the government too, a lot of social programs. Four, and equally as important as everything else, if you're going to attack Iran, as I firmly believe, but I can't prove because it hasn't happened yet, Bush will not leave office without doing something about Iran. It may not be an attack, but he does not like those people, doesn't want to leave office, that problem for the next president. If you're going to attack Iran, America, you cannot attack it as long as Hezbollah lives, because Nasrallah and Hezbollah have hundreds of missiles that can perhaps certainly go to Haifa, and perhaps many of them can hit Tel Aviv. So they are a deterrent to us. So imagine the value of getting rid of Hezbollah, his rockets, a terrorist, supporting the government, and also getting a game plan, a demo, if you will. I used that word in the article. I quoted somebody as saying, for how to do it in Iran. It's a win-win-win, they think.
Okay, we're talking with Seymour Hersh, staff writer for The New Yorker. Obviously, it didn't happen the way some thought it would in Lebanon. To what extent do you think, and of course you wrote your article before the cessation of hostilities, what do you think is going to happen now? Will those who are in other parts of the military, other parts of the Bush administration now have the upper hand and be able to argue that it didn't work?
Well, you know, One of the fears people, I was talking to people, you know, obviously until last week when the peace talks seemed near, it was clear that the war was a disaster. It's clear to everybody except our president, who said yesterday that Israel won. And he didn't say the moon is made of green cheese, but he might as well have said that. I don't know what planet, you know, he's on, but that's what he said. And by the way, I think he believes it, which is really very, even more troublesome. It's not just politics. He really does believe Israel won this, just like he believes Iran is doing great and Afghanistan's going to be fine. As I say, it's just, I'll leave it all for your audience to ponder. It's really scary, though. In any case, it's clear it was a debacle and it wasn't working. And guys were saying to me, and there's an element of this in the piece, a couple of paragraphs about this idea that, you know, you cannot get these guys to live in the real world. They live in a fantasy land. Intelligence that contradicts what they believe doesn't get to them. You have to drink the Kool-Aid to get into a meeting with these guys. In other words, you have to, you know, like the Jimmy Jones and British, everybody who committed suicide, you have to drink the Kool-Aid. And the other thing that somebody said to me, and again, once again, they're beginning to stovepipe intelligence that's coming in that makes the case that the White House wants to make, is gone, particularly Israeli stuff, comes right into the Cheney's office, not analyzed by outside agencies. So we're back in this dream world again. And I'll tell you why we had a president that for 4 weeks publicly talked about after the Israeli bombing about never, you know, here we are, the America, I always thought we were the moral leaders of the world, not calling for immediate end of bombing, despite the fact it was horrific what was happening into non-Hezbollah areas of Lebanon and, of course, all over northern Israel, where there were also terrible counter damage from Hezbollah. So for us to spend, the president to spend 4 weeks in Condi Rice talking about no ceasefire can be done until it's sustainable is basically putting them right into the Israeli pocket, right in front of all of us. And why did they ask for a ceasefire in the end? Because they know it's over. It was a disaster. If Omar finally got through, Omar and those equally as thick-headed people in Israel.
You began this, Seymour Hersh, with the New Yorker magazine by talking about strategic bombing. At the end of your article, you say that from a historical standpoint, going back all the way to World War II, strategic bombing doesn't work the way people think it's going to work. Explain that a bit, if you will.
Well, one of the things we know from World War II is America began to, in 1944, we and the Brits decided to change tactics and no longer we're just going to bomb military targets in Germany. We began the target of civilians. There's been a lot of books written in the last decade inside Germany. For the longest time, it was suppressed because the Germans thought they deserved it. But we began mass bombing of civilian cities. You know, everybody knows Dresden was the fire raged, and hundreds and millions probably of people were essentially caught up in our murdered or killed, if you will, in the bombing. Wasn't much sympathy for Germany after the war. But in fact, studies that were done by a strategic bombing survey, Robert McNamara was one of the people, the former Secretary of Defense who was on it, showed that Germany, despite all this bombing, produced more tanks and planes in 44 than earlier. I mean, in other words, we couldn't really stop production because people were so motivated by the bombing, they worked harder under worse conditions. Similarly, at the end of World War II, Curtis LeMay in 1945, in February of 45, we were beginning the devastating bombing and firebombing of Tokyo and other major cities. This is before the atom bomb. And LeMay in February of 45, at a later memoir, lamented about the fact that there were no more targets. He was sending planes, there were no more targets, and you know what? These guys are still fighting. And if you think the nuclear weapon had a lot to do with it, but once we said we were going to keep Hiroshima, the empire, allow him to stay, that's when I think the end of the war became possible. Of course, there's a lot of scholarship on this. So strategic bombing, shock and awe, did not work in Iraq. It didn't do a thing. It certainly didn't in Vietnam. We did an awful lot of bombing of the North, and also in the South, B-52 bombing, and we managed not to take out the Viet Cong. There's just a terrible track record. And you know what? I'll tell you something. Since I've been doing this stuff sort of constantly for the last year, I know a lot about the Air Force planning in Iran, the planning that was rejected pretty much by our American military, including the Joint Chiefs. And one of their plans said this. This is a plan very earlier this year. Let's do 36 to 48 hours. This is one of the options they gave the White House. Let's just bomb everything, not only the suspected nuclear sites, and it's not clear how far along Iran is on the nuclear business anyway, but let's hit infrastructure. Let's hit oil, the oil works, the water works, the electrical power plants, the roads, the tunnels, so that when the people after 36-hour barrage, the 8 or 9 or 10 million people in Tehran, come out of their bomb shells, look around and see the damage, they'll say to themselves, man, these mullahs are really to blame for this. And let's go and get rid of the mullahs and put a secular government. This was the thinking. And so lo and behold, after the kidnapping of two soldiers, by the Hezbollah, which wasn't a smart, it did happen, but it's certainly nobody rationally would believe that the Israeli response of 35-day mass bombing was proportional. It clearly was. They were tripwired looking for an event. But what was the first thing they bombed the first day? And the audience will remember it. One of the first big visuals we had is they took out the airfield. They bombed the runways. They bombed bridges. They bombed roads. They haven't gone to water and power yet. That's a deterrent still. But it was clear the Israelis were, and also said publicly, their goal was, Hezbollah is mostly Shia, the goal was to get the Sunnis and the Maronites, Catholics of Lebanon, about 50% of the popularity between the two of them, to rise up against the Hezbollah and be hostile to them.
All right. We are simply out of time. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy about what Seymour Hersh is saying. Again, he's probably America's most foremost investigative reporter at this time, staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. Was the theory the same in Lebanon as it might be, again, in Iran? We don't know that as yet. The White House has already denied Seymour Hersh's piece. But thanks very much for being with us. Good to hear from you and look forward to the next one.
Next time I'll let you get a word in, I promise.
Okay.